Belt, folks whose political leanings reflected those of hometowns in the industrial Midwest. In particular, Shale could tell, heavily white areas were coming in hard for Trump. At the same time, in the suite at the Peninsula, Bill got on the phone with Craig Smith, his guy in Florida. "What's going on?" Bill inquired. "Numbers are tighter than they're supposed to be," Smith said. "Where are we not hitting our numbers?" Bill asked. Smith gave him a readout similar to the one Shale was reporting to the consultants in the Midtown boiler room. Pinellas, Polk, and Volusia counties were the bellwethers he used. The campaign should have been overperforming Obama in those spots, and it was underperforming him. All over the state, the returns looked the same. Shale and Smith knew there just weren't enough votes left in Democratic territory to offset the Trump surge. "You're going to come up short," Shale told Margolis and Anzalone. At 8:03 p.m., on the campaign's hourly election night conference call, veteran Clinton consultant and summoner of gray clouds, Mandy Grunwald, told Mook she didn't like the early returns in Virginia. "These numbers are looking pretty soft," she said from the Midtown boiler room. "They're a little soft," Mook agreed from his perch at the Peninsula. "But our model is holding." "It doesn't look like the model is holding," Grunwald shot back. After talking with Anzalone and Margolis, Shale started getting text messages from Clinton number crunchers in New York who didn't see what he did in Florida. He'd set off an alarm bell, unnecessarily in the view of some of Hillary's senior aides. They demanded to know what data he was using to determine that the race in Florida was over so early. But inside one of the rooms on the Clinton floor at the Peninsula, a frightening realization slowly took hold of Mook and Kriegel as they watched results pour in from must-win states. Their vaunted model was way off in Florida. Worse, they had missed the mark in North Carolina, too. Shale, they saw, was right. They could win without Florida or North Carolina, but the way Trump was running up the score in areas full of non-college-educated whites sent shivers down their spines. If the models were so wrong, they could be off in the same way in other parts of the country. They were looking at the early warning signs of a wave. All they could do was hope that it didn't wash over the Rust Belt. Not only were Florida and North Carolina, separately, the keystone states for two of Hillary's three paths to victory, but the campaign had poured money, time, and surrogates into both of them. Hillary had closed her campaign just hours earlier with a midnight rally in Raleigh, and her first joint appearance with Obama back in June had been in Charlotte. She had unveiled her running mate Tim Kaine in Florida. She could afford to lose one or both of the states, but the chances of her winning the presidency would shrink dramatically. Mook walked down the hall and into the Clinton suite, where he found Bill and Hillary in the living room. He stood over them, Hillary sitting in a big chair and Bill on the couch, and did his best not to sugarcoat what he was seeing in the numbers. "We need North Carolina, Florida, or Pennsylvania, and then we need other states," he told them. "Florida and North Carolina don't look great." He stopped short of telling them that Hillary would lose Florida, but he knew that he could be looking at the front edge of that terrifying wave. "We need to see if this is a Southeast problem," he said. While there was a chance that ex-urban voters in Florida and North Carolina were a bellwether for their counterparts in the Rust Belt, he explained, it was also possible that the effect would be limited to the region. Hillary sat stone-faced, trying to process the unexpected and abrupt reversal of her fortunes. "Okay," she said over and over as she nodded. It was all she could muster. Down in Florida, Craig Smith's phone rang. the former White House political director and the very first person hired onto Bill Clinton's 1992 campaign, had been ignoring calls and texts. This one he took. The raspy voice on the other end of the line asked him if Florida could be turned around. "Sorry to be the one to tell you," Smith said in an Arkansas drawl echoing the former president's, "but we're not going to win Florida." Bill hung up and called Governor Terry McAuliffe, who was eager to depart Virginia for the victory party at the Javits Center. "Don't bother coming," Bill told him. On the campaign's regular conference call in the 9 o'clock hour, Mook gave his assessment to the rest of the team. "We're confident," he said. "We underperformed our model in the Southeast, but it doesn't yet appear as a trend borne out nationally." Normally upbeat, Mook said this with a little extra gusto. He knew he had to sell it, because the message was so different from what he would say if he were truly confident. "We're feeling really good about Florida." His optimism did the trick for most of the officials on the call joining the peninsula with Brooklyn and the Midtown Boiler Room, but not everyone. Already, recriminations were beginning to fly. Benenson pointed his finger at the analytics team, which had failed to predict Trump's turnout. In a second conversation with Hillary and Bill, after more of the returns had come in, Mook pivoted. The moment of truth, the reporting of votes in key Rust Belt states, would soon be at hand. "I don't see how we win Florida and North Carolina," Mook said. "So now it's all eyes on Pennsylvania, and then probably Michigan and Wisconsin as well." Hillary was still surprisingly calm, unable or unwilling to delve into the details of how her dream was turning into a nightmare. Bill was less reticent. He'd had a sinking feeling that the British vote to leave the European Union had been a harbinger for a kind of screw-it vote in the United States. He'd seen the transatlantic phenomenon of populist rage at rallies across the country, and warned friends privately of his misgivings about its effect on Hillary's chances. Now his focus turned back to the international movement he'd seen gathering. "It's like Brexit," he lamented. "I guess it's real." Around 10 p.m., Mook jumped back on a conference call with top campaign officials and repeated, almost word for word, what he'd said the last time, about being hopeful that the dynamics in Florida and North Carolina wouldn't be evident in the Rust Belt states. The first time, he'd only talked about Michigan and Wisconsin. This time, he said, three Rust Belt states. Pennsylvania, long thought to be fairly safe Democratic territory, was now in play. Hillary had run up the numbers as expected in Philadelphia and its suburbs, but the turnout for Trump across the spacious state looked a lot like what they had seen in Florida. On this call, Mook sounded less confident about his bullish message. "I know Robbie," one aide on the call thought, "and that does not sound like he believes what he's saying." He didn't. Mook could only help others suspend their disbelief for so long. "We definitely saw it, but we believed what Robbie was saying on the first call," one of his lieutenants said. "But when you start seeing real numbers coming in from the Pennsylvania T or upstate Michigan, you see actual data that confirms your fears." Over the course of a few hours on election night, the Democratic universe had gone from the boisterous expectation of shattering that highest, hardest glass ceiling to the silence of nervously awaiting an uncertain outcome, to the solitude of an impending defeat. The evolution attacked the Democratic body politic in waves of stomach-turning recognition, emanating from the four electronically connected nerve centers in New York, the Peninsula, the Brooklyn headquarters, the Midtown Boiler Room at Hillary's personal office, and the Javits Center, where thousands of supporters had gathered. At the Hudson Mercantile Party, they kept waiting for a change for the better. Instead, positive returns were few and far between. At the Javits Center, campaign aides had gathered backstage in a space that looked like a loading dock, complete with exposed pipes and drapes doubling as walls to separate rooms. Some had arrived at the crack of dawn, eagerly awaiting poll closings with the cautious optimism of frontrunners. Early jitters about Virginia settled after word came through that Mook and Kriegel thought it would be fine. But everyone could see that Florida and North Carolina were going sideways. Like the senior officials at the Peninsula, the Midtown Boiler Room, and the Brooklyn headquarters, but on a little bit of a time delay, these aides were slowly realizing that Hillary's chances of winning the presidency would boil down to her performance in the Rust Belt. About 9:30 p.m., one of Hillary's consultants sidled up next to spokesman Jesse Ferguson at a urinal. "The early numbers in Michigan looked so bad," the consultant said, "that Hillary was probably finished." On the convention hall floor, grown men and women groaned with each burst of additional bad news. Some cried. Others left early. The block party, once so boisterous, cleared out quickly, and a spillover room just off the stage never filled as aides had anticipated. The torture was excruciating, in large part because while it was clear Trump was outperforming expectations, the races in Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin were too close to call definitively. They were all much worse for Hillary than her private modeling and public polling had projected. It would take some time to figure out just how bad. The campaign had a contract to hold the Javits Center until 2:30 a.m. Eastern Time, but the program was only long enough to last until 11 p.m., the time at which Hillary had originally expected to know definitively that she'd won. As that program wound down and 11 o'clock approached, optimism was in short supply. In the Midtown Boiler Room, Anzalone tapped out a message to a reporter who asked what was happening. "Wish we knew," he wrote. "Our analytics models were just really off. Time to go back to traditional polling. This happened in the primaries as well. They just put too much faith in analytics. We did not do any tracking by pollsters for the last month. Just maddening." In the conference room next door, Hillary's states team, keeping track of the operations and results in each of the states, flipped the TV to the reviled Fox News channel. The other networks simply weren't calling races as aggressively. At 11:30 p.m., Fox's Megyn Kelly reported that Trump had won Wisconsin and, in the same breath, explained the real significance of the state's 10 electoral votes. "There goes her blue wall." Until that moment, most Democrats, including most of Hillary's team, believed that she would hold the states that Democrats had won in every election since 1992. Called the blue wall, these states accounted for all but 28 of the electoral votes she would need to capture the presidency. None of the states she'd lost to that point, not Florida or North Carolina or Ohio, was part of the blue wall. Wisconsin wasn't even the most vulnerable brick. Mathematically, she could still win, but it would take a miracle on a night when Hillary couldn't catch a break. A nation of Democrats sat in stunned silence. They hadn't been warned. Hillary hadn't been warned. Even her pollsters had been in the dark, sidelined in favor of an analytics team that insisted she was poised to win. High above Times Square, disbelief stifled the once boisterous boiler room. It fell quiet. A new reality took hold. Short of a divine reprieve, Hillary was going to lose. Donald Trump would be president. "No one saw this coming," Anzalone told the reporter. At 11:11 p.m., White House political director David Simas was seated at a conference table in the West Wing, looking at results with fellow Obama aides and perusing Twitter when the AP called North Carolina for Trump. At the time, Hillary was leading in Pennsylvania, but many of her strongholds had already reported vote counts. 20 minutes later, Fox News called Wisconsin for Trump, a judgment that other news agencies declined to validate for hours. At the White House, the writing on the wall was clear. It was just a matter of time before Donald Trump would be declared successor to Obama. When he was sure there was no path to victory, and after having conferred with the president, Simas placed a call to Mook, who was in Hillary's suite at the Peninsula. "What's going on in your camp?" Obama's aide asked. "I don't think we're going to win," Mook replied. "I don't think you are either," Simas agreed. "POTUS doesn't think it's wise to drag this out." Mook now stood between a president interested in ensuring the smooth Democratic transfer of power after Trump had complained for months that the election might be rigged, and a candidate who hadn't yet given up on the idea that Rust Belt states might flip in her direction. Mook stalled. "Look, we're waiting for a few things," he explained to Simas. "Pennsylvania needs to get called. That's the linchpin." Beyond that, Mook had made a deal with Trump campaign manager Kellyanne Conway that a concession call would come within 15 minutes of the Associated Press declaring a winner in the overall race. That hadn't happened yet. "And," he said, "I think we're getting awfully late for her to go out and give what's an important speech." After all, Hillary was the first woman ever nominated for president by a major political party, and she would want to recognize the achievement in a way that elevated rather than diminished it. "Our plan," Mook said, "is for her to go out tomorrow." Simas listened politely, but he didn't like what he was hearing. He reiterated the bottom line. "We can't drag this out," he said. "The president doesn't think it's wise." Mook hung up and steeled himself. It was pretty clear the president had given him a writ, through Simas, to convince Hillary that it was over and that she should concede graciously and quickly. He walked over to Hillary. "The president wants you to concede," Mook told her, adding his own analysis. "I don't see how you win this." "I understand," she said. But she used her place in history as a shield, in the same way Mook just had with Simas. "I'm not ready to go give this speech." Though she focused her pushback on the nature of her remarks, how should she frame the election of Donald Trump? What would she say to little girls and elderly women who treated her as a champion? Could she hit the right notes? The effect was the same. Hillary wasn't quite ready to put an end to the dream she'd pursued for at least the past decade. "You're right," Mook assured her. "I lost. Have a good night," isn't the way to go. It would take more firepower than Mook had, more than a call from a White House aide to one of her aides, to move Hillary. During their call, Simas had asked Mook for Podesta's number so that the president could call his former aide and the chairman of Hillary's campaign. Podesta had just left the Peninsula for the Javits Center. He went over because the campaign's contract expired at 2:30 a.m., which was nearing, and there was still no decision from Hillary on what she wanted to do, other than avoid giving a public concession speech that night. Within the campaign, there was a divide in the ranks. The young, up-and-comer aides thought the election was over and Hillary was just prolonging the inevitable. But some of the veteran Hillarylanders, both because they had seen strange things happen in elections and because this was their last hurrah, argued that the races in swing states were too close to give up on. As aides shuffled between the suite and the staff room down the hall around 1 a.m., they began discussing whether someone should go over to the Javits Center and make a statement, and if so, what it should say. As they were talking, the AP called Pennsylvania and its 20 electoral votes for Trump, removing one of Mook's stated barriers for a Hillary concession. Aberdeen came into the staff room to say that it was time for someone to make the trip to Javits. "Fuck it," Podesta said. "I'll do it." 45 minutes later, Podesta peered out from behind the podium at the Javits Center. Thousands of Hillary supporters had come to watch her make history, but Podesta was so jarringly in the bleak present. His brief remarks reflected the ambivalence of the campaign. "Several states are too close to call," he announced, "so we're not going to have anything more to say tonight." The glum looks on the faces of exhausted loyalists told a different story. Most of them knew it was over and just a matter of how long the misery would extend. Podesta was saying it would be several more hours, at least. "Let's get those votes counted and let's bring this home," he said to polite applause. That was it. No concession from Hillary, no concession from her campaign chairman. The White House had been worried that Hillary might leave it all up in the air, and that's just what Podesta did for her. The night, it appeared, would end without a fully legitimized president-elect. Podesta made his way from the podium to the backstage area, where Hillary's mid- and junior-level staffers had congregated for the previous 20 hours. Facing the bereaved aides, he searched for soothing words. "Thank you," he managed. "Hang in there." It was hardly the kind of pep talk they'd have gotten from a senior official who expected to win. "We all knew it was likely over," said one of the aides. "It wasn't like we were going to win this thing." Hillary cradled the phone. The smooth, confident voice on the other end of the line was as familiar to every American as it was to her. "You need to concede," President Obama told his former Secretary of State. For the past 8 years, their interests had aligned almost perfectly. She'd lent him credibility with her own supporters and in the Washington establishment. He'd given her the State Department springboard from which to relaunch her political career. At one time, she'd thought about distancing herself from him to win the presidency, but their closeness helped her draw contrasts with Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. Obama and his wife, Michelle, had campaigned for Hillary like his legacy depended on her victory. And it did. But now, with Trump the clear winner of the election, the interests of Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton diverged again. The shotgun marriage that had evolved into nearly as much of a friendship as an alliance was no longer Obama's priority. He needed to ensure that the end of his presidency didn't devolve into a post-election circus. He had vouched for the sanctity of the electoral process, and he needed Hillary to follow along. She wasn't ready yet, but she was getting there. One by one, the obstacles were being removed. Pennsylvania was gone. The AP had just declared Trump the winner of the election. Now the president, the one who had convinced her to take the state job by framing it as a patriotic call to duty, was asking her to do the right thing for the good of her country. He wanted her to make it abundantly clear to the public that she wasn't going to fight the result. Hillary was torn. While she was on the phone with the president, her team was still hashing out whether it was worth waiting until morning. There was a lot of discussion about Michigan and Wisconsin and whether the numbers could flip it, said one person involved in those conversations. Moore was among the more ardent advocates for holding off on a concession. But she was in the boiler room, removed from the central discussion. As Hillary and Obama talked, Moore's friends at the peninsula lit up her phone with requests for her to come and talk to Hillary. The pressure on Hillary, from the president and from aides who believed the race was over, had no effective counterbalance. Hillary was tipping toward a concession. After Obama hung up with Hillary, he called Podesta, who was on his way back to the peninsula to meet up with Hillary and the rest of the team there. Podesta had gone over to the Javits Center with the hope, but only the hope, that the campaign would find baskets of votes in late returns in the key Rust Belt states. But he also knew Hillary wasn't ready to make any public statement. Obama was determined to make sure his friend understood that the election was over. "It's done," he said. "Realize that. Deal with it with dignity and move on." After Trump had questioned the legitimacy of the election, the last thing Obama wanted was for Hillary to reinforce that message. As president, it was his job to safeguard the integrity of the political process. Podesta explained Hillary's position that she wasn't ready to face the public and that the campaign was still hoping for a miracle. Obama reinforced what he'd said to Hillary. He didn't see any point in prolonging the inevitable. It wasn't a question of when she would give a concession speech, but rather of making sure that she didn't try to turn the election into a recount mess. Turning around and playing Trump's game of questioning the institutions of American democracy wouldn't be good for the country, he said. With his message now delivered to Hillary, Mook, and Podesta, the president hung up. At the peninsula, Hillary had made up her mind once she'd talked to Obama. She cut off the staff-level debate. It was time for her to talk to Trump. "Give me the phone," she said. "I'm calling him." Mook had watched on TV as Trump arrived at the Hilton to greet his euphoric supporters. He was painfully aware of his agreement with Conway pegging the timing of a concession call. When he'd made the deal, he'd expected to be on the receiving end of the call. Now he scrambled to reach Conway. He couldn't get her to pick up. Eager for Hillary to concede, and to make sure he kept his own word, Mook asked Huma Abedin to try Conway, and failing that, Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner. The delay bought a little bit of time for the camp that didn't want Hillary to concede. Several of them continued to reach out to Moore. Maggie Williams, Hillary's White House chief of staff and one of a small cluster of longtime loyalists at the peninsula, said Hillary should wait. The margins were still so close that the AP hadn't called Michigan. Pennsylvania and Wisconsin were super tight, too. Trump would end up winning all of them by less than 1 percentage point. "Had anybody known that night, no one would have conceded," said one of the aides who favored the cautious approach. Once a concession call was made, though, it would be much more politically difficult to demand careful counting or recounting of each vote. Hillary was done, though. Conway picked up Huma's call and handed her phone to Trump. Hillary took Huma's phone and faked a smile with her voice. "Congratulations, Donald," she said, suppressing the anger that touched every nerve in her body. "I'll be supportive of the country's success, and that means your success as president." Trump credited her for being a smart opponent who ran a tough campaign. The denouement lasted all of about a minute. The news spread fast because Mook was on a conference call with other top officials. Hillary's voice carried over his open line. "She's literally in the background," one campaign aide said. "You could hear her talking to Trump, conceding." Original Hillarylander Capricia Marshall, the former White House Social Secretary and Chief Protocol Officer of the United States, couldn't come to terms with the decision. She retreated to the living room, finding a spot on the couch that had been Bill Clinton's home for most of the night. Now, as Trump made his way to the podium at the Hilton, Bill chomped on the back end of a cigar. Philippe Raines, a third refugee from the discussion around Hillary, came in to watch Trump's victory speech. Bill looked over at the man who'd played Trump in debate prep sessions. I wish it was you up there, he said wistfully. In the fog of a shocking defeat, there was one moment that crystallized everything for Hillary. Not long after the concession call, Huma Abedin approached her once again, phone in hand. It's the president, Huma said. Hillary winced. She wasn't ready for this conversation. When she'd spoken with Obama just a little bit earlier, the outcome of the election wasn't final yet. Now, though, with the president placing a consolation call, the reality and dimensions of her defeat hit her all at once. She had let him down. She had let herself down. She had let her party down. And she had let her country down. Obama's legacy and her dreams of the presidency lay shattered at Donald Trump's feet. This was on her. Reluctantly, she rose from her seat and took the phone from Huma's hand. Mr. President, she said softly, I'm sorry. Chapter 21, The Aftermath. Once she'd spoken to Trump and Obama, Hillary sat down at the long table in her suite's narrow dining room to read the hastily written draft of her concession speech for the first time. Early in the evening, before the polls closed, chief speechwriter Dan Schwerin had chosen not to share a bare-bones version of the concession with her. He hadn't wanted the possibility of defeat clouding her mind, and he was confident she wouldn't be delivering it anyway. But when losing became a likelihood that night, he and fellow speechwriter Megan Rooney had scrambled to meld parts of the victory speech she had planned to give with the concession. Over the course of a couple of hours, they hammered out remarks aimed at comforting Americans who feared a Trump presidency. They went heavy on themes of constitutional protections and mentioned Muslim Americans and women and others who might feel targeted by the new president. The thrust, one Hillary advisor said, was, we stand with them and we see them, and the fact that we lost this election doesn't mean that we're going to stop fighting for them. As Hillary thumbed through the pages, the speech struck her as tone-deaf. It's too charged, she thought, too political. Raines, one of the more than half-dozen advisors assembled around the table, reacted similarly to what he believed would be taken as an unseemly contrast with Trump. When Hillary was done reading, she looked up and told her advisors it was too much. Look, I really just want to concede gracefully, wish him the best, thank everybody, and get off the stage, she said flatly. This is not a moment for me to do more than that. Jake Sullivan, her chief strategist, took the lead in defending the tone. Everything you said, we're going to do in the speech, he said. But you have been saying for many months that he's temperamentally unfit and that he would be dangerous, and if you meant it, you should say it. And you made a case that all these people's rights and safety are in danger. If you meant that, you should say it. Raines countered, if Hillary did that, she would be portrayed in the media and in the minds of many Americans as a sore loser. Hillary had spoken so many times before about the sanctity of American democracy and the importance of a smooth transition of power. This was a time for statesmanship, not partisanship. He worried that it all sounded too much like a campaign stump speech. Hillary agreed. I'm no longer a candidate or public official, she thought. I'm not going to be the leader of a party in the future. I want to exit with grace and do it quickly. It's not my job anymore to do this, she said, her voice growing more forceful as Chelsea nodded in agreement. Other people will criticize him. That's their job. I have done it. I just lost, and that is that, she continued. That was my last race. With clear marching orders, she instructed her speechwriting team to go back to the drawing board and strike a balance shorter on stating values and longer on graciousness. The regal suit Hillary had planned to wear in her moment of triumph, gray with wide purple lapels and a matching satin blouse, sat untouched in her bedroom. The hard-earned lines in her face weren't masked by foundation. Her hair hadn't been touched up and re-coiffed for the cameras, long after they'd captured her going to vote in Chappaqua that morning. "It's a humbling feeling," she'd said at her polling location. But that couldn't compare to the crushing humiliation of the hours to follow. When she could focus on a task and block out the gravity of Trump's election, her defeat, and the end of her dreams of a return to the White House, Hillary was stoic. Her voice was quiet but firm, her face expressionless, and her hands, which she normally used to accentuate her points, were still. When aides apprised her of new information, she responded briefly and without emotion. "Okay," she said over and over that night. She asked Mook which decisions had been misguided, where they had erred in strategy and tactics. "Our data was wrong," he said, defending the allocation of money and bodies on the basis that they were the right moves given the available internal analytics and public polling. "Okay," she replied. Like the rest of the Democratic world, Hillary was in a state of shock. But at a deeper level, she wasn't completely surprised. Over the course of her life, no matter how good things got for her, she was always waiting for the other shoe to drop. When 2/3 of Americans had approved of her during her tenure as Secretary of State, she'd known those numbers would plummet back to earth once she became a candidate again. This campaign had offered too many examples of that dynamic to count. She'd cleared the Democratic field of bold-faced names and then run into a primary rival in Bernie Sanders, who coupled antipathy toward her among some Democrats with his own ability to bring new voters into the process. Each time she thought she'd defeated him, he rose back up to give her fits again. She'd won back the support of African-American voters who had opposed her in the 2008 primary, only to discover that her attention to their concerns pushed away some of the working-class whites who had been her base. When the FBI director announced that he would not recommend charges against her over her private email server, he'd also taken the unprecedented step of condemning her behavior and enumerating the elements of the case against her. She had broken ground as the first female standard-bearer of a major party, but had to listen to shouts of protest while she accepted the nomination. She'd drawn the general election opponent she wanted, and then found him to be a much tougher foe than she'd imagined. She'd won 3 debates, hands down, a long-accepted indicator of success in presidential elections, and they had not been dispositive this time. On the very day that the U.S. intelligence communities pointed a finger at Russia, the most hated country in American politics in her lifetime, and a recording emerged of Trump saying that he liked to grab women by the pussy, WikiLeaks had begun parceling out a month's worth of embarrassing and divisive internal campaign emails that had been housed in Podesta's Gmail account. She'd run a successful campaign to paint Trump as unqualified for the presidency, and then watched voters who thought he was too dangerous for the job back him anyway. And then, riding high in the polls and coasting toward victory in late October, she'd been rocked by a letter the FBI director sent to Congress, implying that a laptop seized in connection with an investigation into her closest aide's husband's sexting might yield new evidence in the probe into her server. Palmieri had coined the dark mantra of the campaign, "We're not allowed to have nice things." But it perfectly described the way Hillary processed her loss as she sat in her suite at the Peninsula. Her mind kept circling back to 2 factors, James Comey and Russia. For the first time that night, she lashed out. Her voice rose. Her eyes grew wider. Her hands began moving again. These guys came in, she huffed. We were doing better until this happened. Bill Clinton nodded in agreement and muttered something about Brexit. As the night wore on, Raines, who had spent the early part of the evening in his room with friends, no longer wanted to be there. Capricia Marshall was furious. The mood couldn't have been more grim. And then the door opened to Clinton's suite. A hotel server wheeled in a cart of sundaes with sprinkles. Hillary finally went to bed, with the bustle of Manhattan's morning rush hour beginning on the streets below. By 8 a.m., she had changed her mind about what she wanted to say to the public. Schwerin and Rooney had spent the wee hours on the floor of Raines's room, paring back passages aimed at assuaging the fears of her supporters and putting a heavier emphasis on her acceptance of Trump's victory. It was one of the toughest speeches they had ever written. At 5 a.m., Schwerin slipped the new version under Hillary's door. Now the speech-writing duo had returned to her suite, along with Sullivan, to go over the concession one last time. They sat down at the dining room table again, along with other advisors, and Hillary told them she wanted to strike a new balance. She had come to the conclusion that her supporters needed to hear a message of inclusiveness in the face of Trump's victory. Not as aggressive as last night, she thought, but it needs something more. We should go further than we have, Hillary said. She had written notes in the margins of her copy of the speech, and she began to dictate from them. I want you to put in the Constitution as a device, she said. She wanted to talk about the freedoms of speech and of the press, and a third bullet that she described as being anti-demagoguery. I think you're talking about rule of law, Cheryl Mills offered. That's it, Hillary said. The speech wouldn't be an enumeration of every subset of the country that Trump had offended or threatened during the course of the campaign. It would be more subtle than that. But, as one of her aides described it, the tone would be graciously critical. Hillary wanted another significant change. In one of the margins, she had drawn a circle with a cross beneath it, the symbol for women. She said she wanted to say something about the glass ceiling, that it would someday be shattered. Rooney added, sooner than we think, and, to all the little girls who are watching this, never doubt that you are valuable and powerful. She and her aides made tweaks right up until the time, around midday, that she stepped to a podium at the New Yorker Hotel. Wearing the Ralph Lauren jacket with the purple lapels she'd expected to put on the night before, and flanked by Bill in a matching tie, Hillary advised those who opposed Trump to approach his presidency without prejudice. We owe him an open mind and the chance to lead, she said. But she also spoke to their fears, affirming American principles she worried Trump might not safeguard. Our constitutional democracy enshrines the peaceful transfer of power, and we don't just respect that, we cherish it, she said. It also enshrines other things, the rule of law, the principle that we are all equal in rights and dignity, freedom of worship and expression. We respect and cherish these values too, and we must defend them. Before she exited the stage, a twice-defeated candidate for the presidency who had represented her country as First Lady, Senator, and Secretary of State, Hillary touched on the Methodist roots at the heart of her approach to private and public life. Let us not grow weary in doing good, she said, paraphrasing Galatians chapter 6, verse 9. For in due season we shall reap if we do not lose heart. On a phone call with a longtime friend a couple of days after the election, Hillary was much less accepting of her defeat. She put a fine point on the factors she believed cost her the presidency: the FBI, Comey, the KGB, the old name for Russia's intelligence service, and the KKK, the support Trump got from white nationalists. "I'm angry," Hillary told her friend, "and exhausted." After two brutal campaigns against Sanders and Trump, Hillary now had to explain the failure to friends in a seemingly endless round of phone calls. That was taking a toll on her already weary and grief-stricken soul. But mostly, she was mad. Mad that she'd lost, and that the country would have to endure a Trump presidency. In other calls with advisors and political surrogates in the days after the election, Hillary declined to take responsibility for her own loss. "She's not being particularly self-reflective," said one longtime ally who was on calls with her shortly after the election. Instead, Hillary kept pointing her finger at Comey and Russia. "She wants to make sure all these narratives get spun the right way," this person said. That strategy had been set within 24 hours of her concession speech. Mook and Podesta assembled her communications team at the Brooklyn headquarters to engineer the case that the election wasn't entirely on the up and up. For a couple of hours, with Shake Shack containers littering the room, they went over the script they would pitch to the press and the public. Already, Russian hacking was the centerpiece of the argument. In Brooklyn, her team coalesced around the idea that Russian hacking was the major unreported story of the campaign, overshadowed by the contents of stolen emails and Hillary's own private server imbroglio. They also decided to hammer the media for focusing so intently on the investigation into her email, which had created a cloud over her candidacy. "The press botched the email story for 18 months, said one person who was in the room. "Comey obviously screwed us, but the press created the story." Hillary wasn't in the room that day, but in private conversations with top aides in the immediate days following her loss, she struggled with the question of why Obama hadn't done more to apprise the public that the Russians had gone way beyond what had been reported. She wondered why the president hadn't leaned harder into making the case that Vladimir Putin was specifically targeting her and trying to throw the election to Trump. "The Russia stuff has really bothered her a lot," one of the aides said. "She's sort of learning what the administration knew and when they knew it, and she's just sort of quizzical about the whole thing. She can't quite sort out how this all played out the way it did." On the long list of people, agencies, and international forces Hillary blamed for her loss, Obama had a spot. In December, a partially declassified U.S. intelligence community report commissioned by Obama would find that Russia interfered with the election in a bid to help Trump. The agencies involved wrote that Putin ordered the effort to tip the race to Trump. Putin most likely wanted to discredit Secretary Clinton because he has publicly blamed her since 2011 for inciting mass protests against his regime in late 2011 and early 2012, the analysts found, and because he holds a grudge for comments he almost certainly saw as disparaging him. In the postmortem, Hillary and her aides identified dozens of reasons she had lost. Low African-American turnout in some key areas, a boost in the white vote for Trump in suburbs, small towns, and rural areas, misogyny, the Comey letters, and the Russians among them. Most of them could be divided into the interrelated categories of narratives and turnout. Exit polls in Pennsylvania showed that Clinton and Obama won women by 13-point margins in 2016 and 2012, respectively. But in a state that has never elected a woman governor or U.S. senator, men favored Trump by 17 points, a massive increase over Mitt Romney's 3-point edge in 2012. From a geographical perspective, Hillary did better than Obama in Philadelphia and its surrounding suburban counties, but lost working-class Democratic strongholds in Erie and Luzerne counties that Obama had carried. In Florida, Trump crushed Hillary in the suburban swing areas outside Tampa and St. Petersburg. As he did nationally, Trump did better with white Floridians than Romney had, doubling up Clinton at 64% to 32%. Romney had beaten Obama 61% to 37% among Florida whites. Turnout in Milwaukee, the key vote center for Democrats in Wisconsin, was off by 60,000 or so votes from 2012, and nearly three dozen counties in the state saw the partisan margin from that year flip by 20 percentage points or more in 2016. Trump won 52% to 41% in Brown County, home of Green Bay, site of the visit that Hillary and Obama canceled after the Pulse nightclub shooting in Orlando. Obama had won the county by 9 points in 2008 and lost it by 2 points in 2012. Hillary, who had been blown out by Bernie Sanders in the Wisconsin primary, never set foot in the state. About a dozen counties in Michigan flipped from Obama to Trump, but one mattered most. Macon County, flush with working and middle-class whites, gave Trump more than his statewide margin of victory. Obama won the county by 16,103 votes in 2012. Trump took it by 48,348 votes, or about four times his statewide margin. The closeness of the race brought into sharp relief the fundamental divide that ran deepest between Hillary's advisors throughout the campaign. After a quarter of a century on the national stage, and as one of the most polarizing figures in American public life for much of that time, Hillary had alienated a significant portion of the electorate before she even launched her bid. It would be difficult to reset preconceived notions. The big challenge of this whole race was there were so many voters who were ungettable, said one high-level campaign aide. Her approach, guided by Mook and informed by the demands of winning the primary, was to build a coalition focused on core strengths, African Americans, Latinos, college-educated whites, and women. But the more she catered to them, the more she pushed away other segments of the electorate. The number crunchers on the campaign paid careful attention to turning out her supporters and chose not to throw money at trying to change minds with traditional door-knocking efforts. Persuasion, they had concluded, just wasn't feasible with face-to-face lobbying. Imagine you're on the ground, and you're sent to suburban white voters to persuade them to support Hillary Clinton, one top aide said derisively. Imagine what that experience would have been like, and how many households you could really change. But another camp, which included Bill Clinton and many of the older generation of aides and advisors, believed it was a mistake to cordon her off from large swaths of the electorate. They understood the value of slicing and dicing voters to make efficient decisions, but they also felt that Hillary should be doing more to show that she wanted every vote. Some of them believed that instead of basing her campaign on Obama's core coalition, she should have begun with the working-class whites and Latinos who fueled her 2008 run and built out. We started from the wrong premise with her coalition, one leading advisor said. Ultimately, it was a battle between those who believed that it was folly to think Hillary could show up in lower population areas and change hearts and minds, and those who believed just as firmly that politics and Hillary's path to victory were fundamentally about doing just that. That elemental split hung over nearly every internal skirmish over strategy and tactics, from the hard and fast reliance on data and the development of her message, to where she held rallies and whether she bothered to distribute campaign literature in swing states. Hillary, who had been the target of so much venom over the years, and who had become a disciple of Obama's data-driven campaign style, sided with a younger generation that heavily favored science over the art of politics. At one point, plans had been laid to replace Mook as the person in charge of her general election campaign. Hillary stuck with him. And after the election, she chose to blame factors other than the strategy she and her campaign manager had pursued. From Hillary's perspective, external forces created a perfect storm that wiped her out. In this telling, laid out in scores of interviews with Clinton campaign aides and advisors for this book, the media bought into an absurd and partisan Republican-led investigation into her email server that combined with Bernie Sanders's attack on her character and a conservative assault on the Clinton Foundation's practices to sow a public perception that she was fundamentally dishonest. From there, Comey's unprecedented public condemnation of her handling of the server, the Russian cyber attacks on the DNC and Podesta's email account, and new voter ID laws suppressed support for her. In a twist, Clinton World sources said, Comey's final exoneration of her enraged Trump backers and pushed them to the polls in droves. Along the way, they said, misogyny played a quiet role in turning men against her without an offsetting boost in support from women. Her most ardent defenders maintain that she nailed every major moment of the campaign. Those debates were her, the Benghazi hearing, her convention speech, her getting off the mat in New Hampshire, said one senior campaign aide. She just does not give up. But another view, articulated by a much smaller number of her close friends and high-level advisors, holds that Hillary bears the blame for her defeat. This case rests on the theory that Hillary's actions before the campaign, setting up the private server, putting her name on the Clinton Foundation, and giving speeches to Wall Street banks in a time of rising populism, hamstrung her own chances so badly that she couldn't recover. She was unable to prove to many voters that she was running for the presidency because she had a vision for the country rather than visions of power. And she couldn't cast herself as anything but a lifelong insider when so much of the country had lost faith in its institutions and yearned for a fresh approach to governance. All of it fed a narrative of dynastic privilege that was woefully out of touch with the sentiment of the American electorate. We lost because of Clinton Incorporated, one close friend and advisor lamented. The reality is, Clinton Inc. was great for her for years, and she had all the institutional benefits. But it was an albatross around the campaign. 1 month after the election, Hillary returned to Capitol Hill, where she'd worked for 8 years as a senator from New York, for retiring Democratic Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid's send-off party. In addition to Hillary, Vice President Joe Biden and incoming Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell gave tribute speeches. So did House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi and New York Senator Chuck Schumer. In her remarks, Hillary joked that, "This is not exactly the speech at the Capitol I hoped to be giving after the election." There was something different about her demeanor and the way she carried herself, said one powerful lawmaker who was with Hillary that day. She'd lost something since the last time they'd seen each other. The stateliness, the confidence, and the air of power were gone. She's the unpresident, the lawmaker thought. Hillary's joke about having hoped to give an inaugural address from the Capitol understated the way she'd treated that possibility during the campaign. It wasn't just that she had hoped to look out over the National Mall and speak to a nation that had just elected her president. She had expected to do that. The defeat had left her at a loss. She didn't have a plan B. Right after Election Day, she'd returned to Chappaqua and begun returning to the semi-normal life of a former public official. She walked in the woods by herself and with Bill, had lunch with a neighbor, and went grocery shopping for Thanksgiving. When supporters came across her in public, they'd started taking selfies with her and posting them online, sparking a Hillary in the Wild meme that Adam Parkomenko, the Ready for Hillary co-founder, turned into a Twitter handle. The smiling photos belied the pain she was suffering. "I'd like to think that photo of her the next day is what it's like," one veteran advisor said of her, looking unburdened. "Inside, there's a person that's crushed," said a longtime friend. "There's a person that's got to rebuild her life." She started that process with small steps, planting a garden outside her house and spending time with her grandchildren. Behind the scenes, she tried to find jobs for some of her aides. In one case, she sent names to Senator Dianne Feinstein, who was hiring for posts on the Senate Judiciary Committee. Worried about what her loss would mean for the big-ticket Obama policies, she instructed her aides to talk with White House officials about what could be done to protect the Dreamers, those undocumented immigrants who were brought to the United States as children, and key elements of Obamacare. As for her own future, Hillary told friends that she was trying to figure out how she could best fight for her values. She wanted to wait on that, she said, because she was concerned that she could unintentionally incite supporters who despised Trump. "We will rise," she assured one confidant in a text message. It was a theme Hillary revisited a lot in the shadow of the election, as the thought of getting back off the mat helped her work through the jarring finality of the end of her presidential ambitions. She's really allowing herself the vulnerability and the openness that come with a broken heart, said one friend. She's allowing herself to be mad. She's allowing herself to be grief-stricken. But Hillary, who had yet to settle on her path forward, told friends she would bounce back and rededicate herself to fixing problems. Before she could do that, there would be one final humiliation. As a former First Lady and someone who had emphasized the significance of a peaceful transition of power, she would attend Trump's inauguration. When the friend asked her about it in December, Hillary hadn't yet made up her mind about that, but she believed it would be a bruising experience if she did go. "They'll probably boo me," she said. In January 2017, shortly before Trump's inauguration, a friend casually mentioned to Hillary the recent reports that she might run for mayor of New York. "A lot of people are calling me," she replied, declining to shut the door completely. Before that, and just days after the election, the New York Post had reported that Chelsea Clinton was being groomed to run for Congress in a district long held by family ally Nita Lowey. The Clintons and their allies weren't ready for the end of their era when it came. They had been planning on a triumphant return to the White House, not just during this last campaign, but ever since they handed the keys over to George and Laura Bush in 2001. For their entire adult lives, Bill and Hillary Clinton had been plotting a political rise, first his, then hers. Suddenly, shockingly, they were without an office to seek or hold. The absurdities of the election, Russian cyber attacks, a rogue FBI director, and an orange-hued reality TV star winning the Republican nomination, intensified the sense of grief for Hillary, Bill, and their inner circle. None of it seemed fair, and it had all happened so fast. No one in Clinton world wanted to accept the end, but it had come. Hillary had acknowledged as much in her hotel suite on election night when she told her staff that the 2016 election was her last race. An even more symbolic affirmation followed 8 days later when she spoke at a Children's Defense Fund event honoring her. Her remarks that night, which included a powerful anecdote about her mother, were largely taken from the victory speech she'd never given on election night. At the CDF event, Hillary spoke of Dorothy Rodham, age 8, sitting on a train with her little sister, on their way to live with family who didn't want them. "I dream of going up to her and sitting next to her and taking her in my arms," Hillary said, "and telling her, as hard as it might be to imagine, your daughter will grow up to be a United States senator, represent our country as Secretary of State, and win more than 62 million votes for President of the United States." The original line from the undelivered victory speech ended differently. "As hard as it might be to imagine, your daughter will grow up and become President of the United States." Note. In reporting this book, we spoke to a wide variety of sources with insight into Hillary Clinton's campaign, as well as other aspects of the 2016 election. We spoke to them almost exclusively on background so that they would feel comfortable revealing sensitive information and observations during the height of the race, and so that they would not have to fear reprisals. In many cases, we describe what someone thought. Obviously, we are not able to read minds. Instead, the thinking is derived from interviews in which a source said he or she thought something, those in which sources described what someone else said about his or her own thinking, or documents that suggest what a person was thinking. Much of the voting data came from uselectionatlas.org. This is Kimberly Farr. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Shattered, Inside Hillary Clinton's Doomed Campaign by Jonathan Allen and Amy Parnes. This program was directed by Jill Whitesides, executive producer Kelly Gilday. Text copyright 2017 by Jonathan Allen and Amy Parnes. Production copyright 2017, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.